The following message is by Dr. Jason DeRoshi, Research Professor of Old Testament and Biblical Theology at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and Content Developer and Global Trainer with Hands to the Plow Ministries. You can find more from Dr. DeRoshi at www.jasonderoshi.com.
Greetings, brothers and sisters. Today's focus is on two different books, Esther and Ezra Nehemiah. So we are approaching the end of the narrative story, and I'm hoping you're gaining not only a greater picture of how things flow together in the Old Testament, the framework, the narrative redemptive historical framework within which everything falls, but also gaining a clearer sense in how the Old Testament is driven by messianic hope, a messianic document written from a messianic perspective in order to instill messianic hope. That's the phrase that was coined by my friend Jim Hamilton, and I am right with him, believing that is God's intent. So, two books. One thing that I think I failed to comment on, but I'll do it right now. Some of you have asked, why is it that we have a 1 and 2 Samuel, a 1 and 2 Kings, if they're really one book? Why is there an Ezra Nehemiah if it's really one book? And the short answer for the bigger books seems apparent. And that is that when Hebrew was originally written, it was written without vowels. And so it was pronounced with vowels, but the vowels were only understood. So you grew up learning a consonantal alphabet and just knowing what sounds flowed together. However, when scripture was translated into Greek in 300 BC, Greek has vowels. So all of a sudden, a line that would have taken this much all of a sudden takes double because you're adding vowels to it. And therefore, books got twice as long and needed two scrolls if they filled up one just with the consonantal text. Now, the Jews later, 500 years after Jesus, where Hebrew was not as normal, added their vowels in. The vowels that they had been pronouncing for centuries. But rather than altering the sacred consonantal text, they put the vowels above the line and they put the vowels below the line. So that's what we have, but it's why big books make up two scrolls. And so 1 and 2 Chronicles is different than 1 and 2 Corinthians, which is an actual two different letters. 1 and 2 Chronicles is one book in Jesus' Bible. Ezra Nehemiah is a little bit different because it certainly could fit on one scroll, and it seems as though historically the fact that the first book is devoted to the memoirs of Ezra, it's from chapter 7 forward, it's all in first person. Ezra is writing his own journal entries. And then when you get to Nehemiah, it's Nehemiah's memoirs, his own journal account of what it was, and it's all in first person. And so historically, people began to view these as independent documents, but it appears that, and in Jewish history, it's been consistent this way, that Ezra and Nehemiah have never been intended to be separated. So the goal shouldn't be, I want to gain leadership principles from the second half of the book, but not the first half of the book, but rather to approach Ezra and Nehemiah as a single volume intentionally crafted to focus on two main events, the building of the temple and its people, and then the building of the walls of Jerusalem and Jerusalem's people. So just a comment about size and scrolls. All right. Did I pray yet? Let's do that. Father in heaven, I pause to thank you for your word. Thank you for a rich chapel message that could fill us and challenge us. Thank you that you're over all things and trustworthy. Father, we will be reminded today that in the darkest of days, when you seem distant, you're very present. When it seems like you're not there, indeed, when we read Esther, we can't even find your name, your title on the pages. But when we step back, we see the hand of a very kind and gracious and preserving God. I pray that these students would experience in the midst of potentially the hardest year they've ever endured. I pray that you would show yourself. Thank you that through Christ, you are for us. Thank you that he is seated at your right hand, that all things have been subjected under his feet. And though it is the case, as the writer of Hebrews says, it does not yet appear to us that all things have been subjected. Indeed, you have triumphed over all rulers and over all authorities. You have put them to open shame already at the cross. And one day every eye will see and every ear will hear your exaltation. The knees will bow, whether as the saved remnant or as prisoners of war, but every knee will bow before you. I pray that our hearts would be awakened today, heightened in our hope, bound up in the person and work of Jesus. Thank you for preserving the Jews so long ago from a satanic, serpentine, evil influence in the person of Haman. Thank you for returning the Israelites back to their homeland so long ago that your servant king could arise from Bethlehem in the fullness of time. Thank you that a light has dawned on Galilee of the Gentiles, and that light has now stretched across the globe. Heighten our hope today. Let your word speak today. Minister to weary souls today. And push us from sin. I pray these things through Christ, for Christ, and for the good of each of these students. Amen. All right. The book of Esther. There are a number of allusions in this book that link it to a major book of the past. Based on your reading, what book is that? Anybody? 1 Samuel. A specific story in 1 Samuel that's recalled. Which one? Saul and Agag. So, in the connections actually begin before we ever get to our Saul figure and before we ever get to our Agag figure. The book opens with a setting for God's providential preservation of his people. I've highlighted God's sovereign preservation, providential preservation, because I think that's what this book is about. Though we never see the name of God. I think that's very intentional because it suggests to us that those living in the days of Esther, that's what they may have felt like. Like God was distant. They're in slavery. They're under, what would the word be? Rulers that think they're great and they're not great at all. Rulers who want to display their great authority, and ultimately they have no control even over their own household. And in such a context, The readers, the first readers of this book who encounter this story, feel like God is extremely distant. And I think that the author very intentionally doesn't include any name or title associated with God in order to help us feel it more. And yet to let us step back and see there's far too many things that happen by chance in this book. God is at work from beginning to end. He hasn't forgotten what he declared in the book of Daniel, that his kingdom would come, is going to happen. God is sovereign in the present. He is sovereign over the future. And he was sovereign in the days of Esther to preserve his people in light of the promises that he had made. There are purposes for Israel that have global ramifications. Through you, Abraham, all the world will be blessed. And that's what God is doing in the book of Esther. He's showing us through another Pharaoh-like figure who wants to destroy all the Israelites, like Pharaoh did, like Amalek did when Israel first came out of Egypt. In the battle that Moses had to hold up his hands, as long as the hands were upheld, Israel was winning. When his hands went down, Israel began to lose. And in that battle is when God declared his war of judgment, like he had at the flood, like he had against Sodom and Gomorrah, like he would against the Canaanites. He declared his war of judgment against the Amalekites and declared that ultimately, their name would be cut off from the planet. And that story comes back to bear here. But before it reaches here, it reaches 1 Samuel 15. So we have a setting for God's providential preservation, the experience of God's providential preservation. And then, though we call this book Esther, it's Mordecai who is elevated at the end of the story. And I think both figures at some level anticipate the coming of the Messiah and the hope of those promises, but Mordecai plays that role even more than Esther does. But we begin in the days of Ahasuerus. Some of your translations may say Xerxes. They're the same figure. In the days of Ahasuerus, he reigned from India to Cush. That's ancient Ethiopia. That's how they render it in Greek. Even the Old Testament is inconsistent. This is the Hebrew Cush, which is the central empire of ancient Black Africa. It was housed in modern-day Sudan. And by the time we get to Alexander the Great, they use the Greek term Ethiopia to translate every instance of Cush. So Ethiopia is not relegated to modern-day Ethiopia. Indeed, Ethiopia, or Cush, is the most southern region of the known world of that day. It's the most southern of all empires, and it's ancient Black Africa. So from ancient Black Africa, stretching all the way eastward to India, Persia holds sway. It's a massive empire, far greater than Babylon or Assyria ever were. You see here the Mediterranean Sea, Ramses in Egypt, Jerusalem, move up to Syria proper, where Damascus is. You move up to Haran, where Abraham came from, off the Euphrates River. And then you get Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, Babylon, the capital of Babylon, and now Susa, the capital of the Persian Empire. That's where our story is framed. It begins in Susa, and King Ahasuerus is sitting on his royal throne and a very proud man. Now, as I said last week, he never even had to enter into battle in order to claim all the Babylonian turf. Babylon had stretched itself too thin. They only had an 80-year reign. Persia is going to have a 200-year reign. before Alexander the Great comes and overpowers their kingdom. So he's sitting there having done very little with respect to war and yet being very proud because he is gaining taxes from the entire known inhabited world. He's a wealthy man who's very proud of himself. It says in verse 4, he wanted to show off his royal glory, his splendor, his pomp, his greatness. So he has a feast for 180 days. Dude, half a year he's going to have a party. And at one point he wants to show off his very beautiful bride, and she refuses to be exploited. Then we read these words. Verse 16, then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the peoples who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, well, King Ahasuerus has commanded Queen Vashti to be brought and she didn't come. Why should I have to please you? So how do you build an unhealthy, abusive, complementarian, that is an abusive complementarian context? You make an edict that wives have to obey anything their husband says. This is not a picture of biblical headship. This is oppressive, domineering, not loving, supportive, protective, but abusive. Then we read this, verse 19, our first link with 1 Samuel 15. If it pleases the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be repealed that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. That statement, to another who is better than, occurs only one other time in the entire Bible. And it happens to be 1 Samuel 15. 1 Samuel 15 opens with Samuel telling Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people. I've noted what Amalek did to Israel, opposing them on their way out of Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have done. Don't spare them, but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, and camel and donkey." This is not Saul acting as politician. This is Saul acting as leader of Yahweh's war of judgment. This is about purification and punishment. So Yahweh had declared war, and the humans are merely the agents carrying out that war, and Saul is to be at the lead. And the target is Amalek. God takes sin seriously. He took it seriously at the flood, and he's now taking it seriously against Amalek. He determines when sin will be punished. For Canaan, it came earlier than they would have expected, when all their neighbors were acting the same way that they were, but God had determined that Canaan would be his promised land. He determined that he would bring judgment against Amalek. But as we know, Saul went off and did not kill everything. He didn't kill the animals. We're told that he listened to his people and they said, "We'll save them for sacrifice. Wouldn't that please the Lord?" He didn't kill Agag, the king of the Amalekites. So Samuel takes his sword. Agag thinks he's in good position, and Samuel goes and kills him immediately. And then he says to Saul, here it is, The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you this day and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you. Now in 1 Samuel 28, 17 and 18, it repeats that same phrase and identifies that David is that one who was better than Saul. So in ripping the kingdom away from Saul and giving it to someone better than him, that in some way is supposed to stand, I believe, in the background of our minds when the kingdom is taken away from Vashti as queen and given to Esther. That in the same way that the David figure in the Samuel narrative is elevated ultimately to heighten hope in the one greater than David, who would be better than David, who was better than Saul. So too, the rise of Esther in being better than Vashti sets us up for saying, who's next? But that's a small connection, but it's a fair one because the phrase only occurs in those two spots, and then we're going to see other allusions to 1 Samuel 15 that without them, I would struggle to say, I'm not certain that there's supposed to be an intentional link between Vashti and Esther and Saul and David. But the fact that we're going to see Mordecai arise as a Benjamite and son of Kish, which is exactly how Saul is described, and then to find out that Haman is an Agagite, suggesting he has some ties with the original Agagite in the line of Amalek, all of a sudden, God's intent to destroy not only Haman, but his entire family gains clarity because God is simply fulfilling his long ago pronouncement of judgment against the Amalekites. But all of that is designed to heighten hope in the serpent slayer because all these figures in the story that bear serpentine qualities of wanting to destroy God's people and stand in hostility to Yahweh and his purposes, all of them bearing the qualities of the serpent in the garden, their defeat over and over again in the story, be it Pharaoh, be it Goliath, be it Haman, all of them are designed to heighten hope in the ultimate offspring who is to come. And we're in that part of the Old Testament canon in the writings where that hope is burning bright, where we're just reading story after story, and we've only focused on the narrative books. We didn't get to focus on the commentary books, but each of the former writing commentary books, Ruth, Psalms, Job, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Songs, Lamentations, each one is designed to heighten hope in the Messiah and to give us a glimpse as to what was the remnant, how were they thinking as they lived in darkness in hope of the light? How were they acting? What principles were guiding them? And here in the book of Esther, I think that messianic anticipation is in the backdrop. And this book is written in order to remind the reader, he's coming, he's coming. And Esther and Mordecai are mere pictures of this. So you've got a king with only apparent authority, and now there is the need to come up with a new bride. And it's at this point that Ahasuerus seeks out a wife. So we begin in chapter 2, and here's where the main characters, rather than the foils, the main characters are now going to enter in. Verse 2, let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king. Let the king appoint officials in all provinces of the kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the capital, under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who's in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given to them, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. And the king thought that's a great idea. Now, when I read this text, you could easily say, oh, look, to your 5-year-old daughter, the king of Persia wants to have a beauty pageant. And he's inviting all the young maidens from all over the kingdom, from India to Ethiopia, to gather in Susa for this pageant. Who do you think is going to win? Maybe they'll sing, tap dance. What qualities do they have? They'll answer good questions up on stage, and the king will sit back in his chair on the other side of the room and say, I like that one. But that's not quite the picture I get. The harem was not a beauty pageant. This is a bunch of women who are gathered together, most commonly to be exploited in serious ways. But here's the kicker. If the king demands it and you refuse to participate, you have one option: execution. That's the sense I get. He is that kind of a king. He just did away with his own queen. So when they come knocking on the door, cousin playing the role of father Mordecai has only one option for the life of his daughter that he's aware of. And that is to let her go and to pray for her care. Whether we're to see this as a compromise, as some would assert, I'm not certain. It seems to me he allows his life to be preserved, he allows her life to be preserved, and entrusts these lives into the hand of God. But the man does show up, and we learn that in verse 5, there was a Jew in Susa in the citadel whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Now, I don't know if that is a condensed genealogy like we find in Matthew 1:1. Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And in between Jesus and David and Abraham are all kinds of generations. So that could be the situation here where this is actually reaching all the way back to Saul's dad, the Benjamite Kish. Or it could just be that there's another Benjamite who happened to be named Kish. But the point is, there's a connection. There's a link. He is a Benjamite. His dad also was Kish. And all of a sudden, he's a new Saul figure, because back in 1 Samuel chapter 9, that's exactly what we learn about Saul. So on the side of the good is Mordecai, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. And someone back there, be it Mordecai or Jair or Shimei or more likely Kish, had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. And this Mordecai was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther. Someone asked, why is Esther used throughout the book and not Hadassah? Probably because, one, she's keeping her Jewishness secret, and she's the queen, and is therefore her Persian name is at the fore. No one knows that she's a Jew. So Esther is it, and she gets taken into the custody of Haggai. And we learn in verse 9, the young woman pleased him and won his favor, and then she goes into this extended multi-month treatment. She gets, if you're in chapel, she gets the beauty oils, oil of myrrh, and then 6 months of spices and ointments for women. I can't even think of what this would all be like. But anyway, she's getting ready for a single night with the king. And she goes on her night, and then the next morning she's done. And she pleased the king, and he says, she's my bride. That is exploitation. That is brokenness. We're not supposed to see it as okay. And yet, I don't think we're supposed to understand her as having an option, in the same way that I didn't call what David did with Bathsheba adultery, but rather rape, because of his power. The social relationship doesn't allow for her to have any response in the discussion. So, but God is at work. Should she be marrying a non-believer? No. But the social dynamics don't allow her to do anything else other than die. So I'm not certain that we're supposed to view Mordecai and Esther in a moral compromising situation at this point, or as breaking the law. Could be the case. God is certainly going to redeem it regardless, but I'm not certain because of the nature of the power dynamics that are at play. But there is a greater one. In the same way that God enters into Joseph's world and he's raised up, that same God. There's allusions back to that story as well. Mordecai is going to take on the same role that Joseph played, second in command to the king. Same role that Daniel played. So God is doing something here, and yet it's behind the scenes. So that's the setting for God's providential preservation, now the experience of it. Mordecai is hanging out at the king's gate, and he hears about a coup that is rising up. Two individuals who are wanting to assassinate the king. He lets Esther know. It gets back to the king. The coup is halted, and it's put into the books without any action that Mordecai saved the king. That's a good thing. We might, at this point, say, why is that in the story? Well, we know if we read the story, it's going to come back into a significant, it's going to play a role later on. But at this point, there is this, there's development, there's intrigue, there, every part of the plot matters. Now, at the same time that Mordecai is at the city gate, Haman is coming and going, and he's wanting people to bow down to him. Haman is second in command to the king. Haman has authority. Haman is proud. He delights in other people humbling themselves around his presence, but Mordecai will not bow, just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would not bow. And that infuriates Mordecai, so he comes up with a plot. As you know, he wants to destroy Mordecai because he knows he's a Jew. So not only destroy Mordecai, but destroy all the Jews of the kingdom from India all the way to Cush. Not knowing that Esther herself is a Jew. So he plots, and we read in chapter 3, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, all but Mordecai. Verse 8, Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad, dispersed among the peoples, as if they're really far from you and you have no connection with them, but they're part of your kingdom. and they're rude and rowdy and disrespectful and don't honor the king. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws. So that is not the king's profit to tolerate them. So if it pleases the king, I'll pay 10,000 of my own talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put into the king's treasuries. Just let these people be destroyed. So he pays off the king to have him do his bidding. The king makes the decree, and it's decided by casting of a lot, the rolling of dice, that called the poor, Purim is plural for the poor, and that's the lot. So he casts lots, plural, Purim, which is going to be the name given to the celebration of the Jews at the end of the book. So it's determined that multiple months out, I think it's like 13 months out, or maybe it's 11 months, the Jews are going to be destroyed throughout the entire kingdom. And that sets this stage. And so it is that we move into the next part of this book. So Mordecai hears about the plot against the Jews, encourages Esther to intervene. Esther's nervous to go before the king because without permission, she could be killed. So she has to entrust her life to the providence of God. Verse 14 is foundational to the book. Chapter 4, 13 and 14. Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the Jews. His edict will bring your death as well. Haman's edict will destroy you. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? It would be tricky for me to know how to preach this book without trying to preach the whole book at one time. But to tackle 10 chapters in a single sermon is really, really hard. But the whole story hangs together. But certainly you could leave your people hanging at points. The story leaves us hanging. It makes us wonder what's coming next. And you could preach at least up through chapter 4, potentially in a single sermon, and get people to that point, and then elevate the absolute providence of God and the confidence that Mordecai has in the certainty of preservation, and say, where could such certainty come from? Well, when we put Esther at the end of the Old Testament, all of a sudden we look back and we see such a massive amount of trustworthy provision by this great king. So many promises that have been fulfilled already to heighten hope in the ultimate Big Daddy fulfillment that will come in Jesus and the Messiah. Esther decides, I'm going to do it. She goes into the king. He lets her in. She doesn't die. She comes down the aisle. She touches the scepter. What do you want? Up to half my kingdom, my beautiful maiden. And she says, what I want, sweetie, is for you to come to a banquet, you and Haman. And he's thrilled. This is a side note. So yesterday, this week, for those who may be new students here, you may have never heard of this before, but this week is usually devoted to the meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society. And it's a gathering of Bible and theology scholars from all over the world, and we meet together for a 3-day conference, and it's usually followed by other conferences by more liberal groups that also have conservatives, and I'm a part of those groups as well. But this is where everybody who holds to the Trinity and to inerrancy, we all gather and are able to encourage each other and wrestle with the word. But here, this week, it's virtual. So we had to pre-record our papers. And then last night for me was my 1 hour grill time where professors from all over the world are on the Q&A session asking questions. And then there's a group of us on a panel and we're answering questions based on our papers. But the guy that was in charge of making sure that Zoom and the platform worked was kind of in the background. Nobody out there in the world could see him, but he was there for us in case there were any technical difficulties. And afterward, we found out, so he was a believer. He had recently graduated with his master's degree from Biola. And he was serving the conference by helping everything be controlled. And he said last week he got married. And that was just great news. We were excited for him. But what was funny is that his entire Zoom session was done in a bedroom, a very plain bedroom that had bunk beds behind it. And I said, so he said, yeah, I just got married. And I said, well, I've got to say to you, brother, that the fact that you've got bunk beds behind you and you were married a week ago, that's not really great. And he didn't realize the irony of it until afterwards. And we all laughed. And anyway, the fact is that here's the king. He doesn't only have a different room. He's got his own palace. And Queen Vashti has got her own palace. And he's got to go over to her place in order to have this banquet. Anyway, that was very sideline. So I thought it was very funny, though, last night. And we all had a good crack up. He was very adamant, this is not my bedroom. It was very funny. Anyway. So, you've got the very first night, and we're drawn in. We know what's at stake. We know that, we know what Haman intends. The king doesn't know as we're reading this story, but we know as the reader what's going on. We know the villainous activity of Haman. We know that Esther's life is at stake. We know that the very preservation of the promises of God is at stake. As we're reading the story, and we come into the banquet, and the moment rises right when Esther can say it, and the narrator says, I'm not done with my story yet. And she says, up to half my kingdom. I mean, that's what he says, up to half my kingdom, anything you request. And her request is, come back tomorrow night for another banquet. Unbelievable. But it's part of the narrative intrigue. It's intended to leave us hanging. The entire book of Esther has been played out on stage in a 2-hour play. It's very effective. The narration allows itself to have such a context. I could see it done very effectively. I've done this with Ruth in a church. I haven't done it with Esther. It's a little bit of a bigger book, but I still think it could be done. I don't remember how long it takes to get through all these chapters, but to just have four main characters up on the stage with four mics and then a narrator on the side who holds the story together, and then let your people just feel the weight of the story and have the characters just read it. Get good voices and let them present it. Walk through the entire story in a 35-minute window and then offer pastoral reflection. Doesn't have to be big. Even a paragraph that just lets the story itself hang on the people and see the unbelievable kindness of God. So Esther prepares this banquet, and off they go. The Haman, eager to come the following night, eager to get back to his wife. So we read in verse 9, Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate, all of that animosity rose up again. He demands that a tree, that's the term in the Hebrew text, same term out of Deuteronomy, he who hangs on a tree is cursed. It's used to heighten clarity about the significance of Jesus' death, that he was hung on such a tree. And I think I think that the ESV in translating it gallows, it puts modern day conceptions of what a hanging is in our mind and fails to help us remain in biblical categories. Even if it is a gallows, the fact that it's a tree is designed to help us remember that's where cursed people go. And that's where Haman wants to see Mordecai go. And yet, ultimately, it's the serpent figure who's going to be hung up on the tree in recollection of Numbers chapter 20. So, and in preparation for John chapter 3. So, Haman orders that a tree be erected. So it doesn't appear to be an actual tree. It's a man-made tree that is erected super high in order to hang or impale Mordecai upon. And he goes back and he went to his home, talks to his wife Zeresh. Verse 11, Haman recounted to them the splendor of the riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above all the officials. And then Haman said, "Even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared, and tomorrow also I'm invited to her by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." So his wife says, "Build the tree." Now, the next night, husband and wife's story is going to be a little bit different. Their conversation, that is going to be a little bit different. So, as you know, Haman goes to bed that night with the death of Mordecai and the delight in himself on his mind. I mean, it's a sad situation when he needs to spend much of his evening bragging at his own wife of all that he is. So, as you know, at the same time, when Haman is sleeping, dreaming about Mordecai's downfall, the king can't dream. He can't sleep. He's tormented in his bed, and so he, struggling with insomnia, has the royal annals brought out. And what should happen? But they read for him the story of Mordecai's saving of him, right? And that Mordecai learned about the coup and was able to thwart it by telling Queen Esther. And he asks, "Has anything been done to honor this man?" "No, nothing has been done." And so the king decides something must be done. And the story is starting to turn. The tide at this point is starting to turn. After that first banquet, after that declaration, "Build the tree." If you were preaching the text, you could pause at chapter 5. And leave people hanging with the positive note where it looks like everything has gone well for Haman. Everything is elevating. Mordecai and Esther are in trouble. And then let our people just know, God is faithful. The darkness may seem real. He may seem distant. His name hasn't even been mentioned. But what do we know about our God? How has he proven himself to us over and over again? We will not stop believing in him. We must continue to trust in him, even when we do not know what tomorrow will hold. And close the sermon right there and come back the next week to finish the story. So Haman wakes up in the morning and arrives. The king is intent. He has one thing on his mind, the honoring of the man who has honored him. "What must I do?" he asks Haman, to the one that the king wants to honor. Haman can't imagine anyone in the world that the king would want to honor more than him. And so he builds up this idea. Put him on your own horse. Put your own robe upon his back. Let him be walked through the city of Susa declaring, "This is what happens to the one the king wants to honor." I think we're supposed to feel the irony. There's supposed to be a humor here. Indeed, as you know, this story is read at Purim. This is one of the key feasts that was never mentioned in the days of Moses. It's added into the Israelite religion at this point of history. And the only additional feast that is to come is Hanukkah, which is brought after the Jews are delivered in the days of the Maccabees around 300 BC. And in Jesus' day, Purim is being celebrated, Hanukkah is being celebrated, along with all the major feasts already established in the Pentateuch. But today, when the Jews read this story in their synagogue, this is the feast is a strange combination of Western Halloween, meaning that it's filled with costumes, and yet the joy of a Christmas or Easter. It's all the people get dressed up, you gather to the synagogue. Anybody, do we have any Jews in here that grew up going to synagogue and celebrating Purim? Okay, so the Jews, in celebrating the story, they gather together, and as the story is read, it is a lively crowd. And the children are all dressed up, and every time Haman's name is mentioned as they're reading through the scroll, every time his name is mentioned, everybody, they've got sound machines. It's like the opponents during the guys' basketball team game trying to shoot a free throw, and our very kind, respectful fans are going, shh, the entire time he's trying to throw it. So they're booing. Every time Haman's name is mentioned, it's boo, boo. And the moms are screeching and the kids are yelling. And because this is a story of he's the villain, he's the bad guy, and everybody knows it. There's a humor about it because we know what happens in the story. So as we know, the king turns the tables on Haman. Mordecai is the one you have to answer. So then Haman has to walk Mordecai through the city. This is what happens to the one the king wants to honor. This is, and on they go. And Mordecai is now on this, on the horse, elevated above Haman. Well, Haman is humiliated, and he goes now to talk to his wife. And tells his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him." Already they predict his doom before the banquet. So in comes the second banquet. And Ahasuerus is there, Haman is there, and it comes to the moment up to half my kingdom, Ahasuerus says to his bride, and she declares, there is a plan to murder me and to murder all my people. Haman is the one who did it. Now the king is appalled. He can't believe it. He leaves the room. Haman apparently falls down on the ground and grabs her legs or something, falls upon her, pleading for help. And then the king comes back in and thinks he's not only wanting to kill his bride, but rape her. And so off Haman goes, off to his own tree to be killed. But that still leaves this issue of the dilemma. The dilemma of the Jews and the edict that cannot be turned around. So after the king says, hang him on the tree. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Who was he? He was Haman the Agagite. Who overcomes him? Mordecai, the Benjamite, the son of Kish. Agag, if we're supposed to, it seems as though the fact that it's the son of Kish, a Benjamite, the fact that it's Agag, an Agagite, it seems as though it's most likely, meaning that he's biologically connected after 500 years removed, biologically connected to the same Agag, the Amalekite, that Saul failed to kill. But regardless, as an Agagite, his name signals the connection. And it recalls all those stories of the Amalekites trying to kill Israel, of Saul's failure to destroy the Amalekites, and now of a new Saul figure through whom God ultimately brings an end to the Amalekites. Why must all of Haman's family be destroyed? Because they're part of the Amalekites upon whom God had declared destruction. Every man, woman, boy, and girl bound up in the sins. And therefore, executed by God. So as you know, bringing this story to a conclusion, verse 2 of chapter 8, the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman. He gave it to Mordecai. Mordecai becomes the second man in command. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. A new decree is written that the Jews are able to defend themselves when the timing determined by the roll of the dice comes about, that they're able to defend themselves throughout all the kingdom. And so verse 11, the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, to annihilate any armed force of the people or province that might attack them, children, women included, and to plunder all their goods. That's what the king allowed. But intriguingly, no plundering happens and no goods are taken, which appears to be reaching all the way back to the Pentateuch's discussion of how Yahweh's wars of judgment were to be carried out. And we're supposed to view it in that light. No plunder taken in these instances. And the Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor, chapter 8, verse 16. In every province, in every city, wherever the king's command and his edict reach, there was gladness and joy. There was a holiday and a feast. Many from the peoples of the country declared themselves Jews for fear that of the Jews had fallen on them. This is crazy. They're not even ethnically Jews, but they're like, I want to hang out with you because you're going to have the greater power on that day. I don't want to be at all viewed as your enemy. And all of a sudden, people are wanting to identify themselves with Esther and with the Jewish people. So the day comes, and then a second day in Susa comes, and God allows the Jews to be defended. Mordecai establishes Purim as the perpetual celebration, two-day festival of this great deliverance. And then we read in chapter 10, King Ahasuerus imposed a tax on the land and on the coastlands of the sea, and all the acts of the power and the might and the full account of the high honor of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Ahasuerus. He was great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brothers, for he sought the welfare of his people, and he spoke peace to all people. I don't know how you could, like with the book of Kings, we just kind of did selective parts and we walked through, but we jumped over so much. With a book, a story like this, you can't leave any part out. So you've either got to work through the whole story in a single message or try to package it in a way that leaves your people hanging in an appropriate way that the story itself wants to leave us hanging, and then pick them up and finish things off. So this was a picture that you saw in the textbook of some modern day Jewish kids attending Purim. You've got a princess, Lone Ranger figure, Zorro. I'm sure they're not thinking in those categories, but it's something like that. He's even got a pistol on his hip here. You've got a pilot. So they're just gathered the same kind of costumes that our kids might put on during Halloween. So let's just consider the lasting message here of this book. God, whose title and name is never found in this book, seems to me to be present. We're supposed to read it in light of the sovereign testimony given in the testimony of the sovereign one given in the book of Daniel. That same vision of that grand God, we read that grand God into the story. And so though he seems distant, he was present at the... He was the one who provided Daniel the revelation of the mystery of the image dream. He was present at the fiery furnace. He was present giving Daniel an understanding of the writing on the wall. He was present in the lion's den. That same God is present now. Even though he seems distant, he is there. And I think that's what we're supposed to see. And his absence in word, in his name, is simply part of the rhetorical purpose of the book. Number two, God will punish the wicked who stand against his people. That's part of the message and the hope of this book. That all serpentine offspring, and indeed the serpent himself, will be crushed, though it may come through suffering. Mordecai is the ideal Saul who succeeds where Saul failed. Saul, a Benjamite and son of Kish, failed to kill Agag, king of the Amalekites, after God declared war against the Amalekites for trying to destroy the Israelites upon their departure from Egypt. Mordecai, a Benjamite and son of Kish, reverses Saul's failure. Haman was an Agagite, apparently a descendant of the Amalekites, or at least one representing evil like they did. And so it was that Mordecai was the instrument of the Agagites' downfall, both him and his family. Mordecai's victory over Haman foreshadows the coming Messiah's victory over the serpent-like beastly kingdoms of mankind. Mordecai, the new Saul, succeeds where the original Saul had failed, and the story of Esther comes to an end, expecting that the new Saul, that is Mordecai, will be followed by a new David. It's significant that the Messiah figure is not in the line of Judah. Rather, he reminds us of the character of Saul. He succeeds where Saul failed, and then what we're expecting is David to actually follow. That's the hope of this book, that the one greater than Mordecai is going to arrive. The new David, the Messianic King. The Messiah in the line of Judah will bring ultimate joy. So what the new Saul figure from Benjamin brings in joy to all the people rather than great pain, you'll recall the mourning that takes place when the Benjamites of Gibeah, which is exactly where Saul was from, the Benjamites of Gibeah in the book of Judges deplore themselves through sexual immorality and incite across all the Israelites a civil war. Now this new Saul figure obeys where Saul should have obeyed, and he incites joy across all the peoples of Israel. And it heightens hope for the greater figure to come who will bring greater joy. So here's my summary. God discreetly and sovereignly preserves his people from Haman's extermination by honoring Esther over Queen Vashti and Mordecai over Haman, resulting in his people's joy in order to foreshadow the Messiah's future work. Let's pause there. A number of you had questions on Esther. Who wants to ask any of them? Esther questions. Okay, great question. So the observation is, why do I seek to affirm Bathsheba and affirm, what's her name? Esther. In saying they didn't have a choice. It would have been death or follow the king, and that it was okay for them to enter in, follow the king, versus Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who said, we will not bow down. And even if we die, we'll accept whatever comes. So that's a great question. My initial response is twofold. One, there's a definite difference between them being men and being women. It's very likely Esther, though without her help in Mordecai, would have had to go to the harem regardless. Regardless of what Bathsheba says, David's disposition of sin and failure to take sin seriously, he was going to do what he was going to do, even if it means killing her husband in order to preserve his act. So, should Mordecai, the dilemma is a challenging one, in that in Mordecai standing up and saying, no, she cannot go, he likely would have been knocked off and she would have had to go and yet be there without a protector. The second issue at stake, though, is the fact that it was clear what the future was for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and what was being called for. They had to bow down now or be thrown into fiery furnace now. For Esther, we know what the king's plan is, but we also know that he's a defunct king who can't keep order. And so it could be that Mordecai, as he's wrestling with this, I'm either not present or I'm present. And we do not know how God could preserve Esther and whether she'd have to go through this at all. Now, I don't know. I think it's when believers confront moral compromise, wanting to know what wise as serpents and innocent as doves looks like, it becomes challenging. And it seems to me that there is just grounds for saying Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego made the only choice they could. There was only one option as a believer. They had to choose death. Otherwise, it would have been compromising their faith. For Esther and Mordecai, I don't see necessarily that there was only one option. I'm not certain they're compromising their faith in letting her go. Indeed, it may be an expression of their faith and Mordecai's attempt to act in love, all of which God ultimately uses to bring about the preservation. But the situations aren't equal. The fact that we have females versus males, and the fact that it's not an immediate issue of compromising loyalty to Yahweh that was at stake. Now, ultimately, she has to marry the king. And all of a sudden, you have what would appear to be a follower of Yahweh married to a non-believer, having to sleep with a non-believer. And it was, I mean, maybe we're supposed to say she should have never done it. I don't know how she had a choice in the matter. And so God enters into a very broken situation and works it. But it's a great question. I wish I could sit down and hear more. Anybody else have any thoughtful reflections on that question that you'd want to contribute? So the question is, even though we're reading between the lines, it does appear that Mordecai has faith in God, and could it be that in his wrestling, he gained that sense of assurance, this is the route we should take? Now, what we want to be sure about as we consider such things is that as we consider personal impressions from God that are applications of, that they have to be applications of biblical principles for specific modern day situations. What I mean is that we can't say God ordered me to do X and X is sin. We know that that would never happen. God led me to Midwestern. I bet some of you have said that. And someone would say, well, when I used to teach I was at University of Northwestern, which is a Christian college, and not 2 miles north of Midwestern was Bethel University. So we would go to Amos 4:12, go to Bethel and sin. That was, a lot of the students liked that verse. So that's why I came to Northwestern, they would say. But there were lots of great people at Bethel. But we don't have those kinds of texts. God led me to Midwestern. God's calling me into the ministry of biblical counseling, of pastoral care, of missions. What do you mean by God's calling me? Well, what do you mean? God talked to you? In what way? And so what we know is that anything God says today won't compromise this. Everything is weighed up against this. I'm thinking specifically of how Paul talks in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 when he says, and I agree with these words, do not quench the spirit. I think these words matter for the 21st century as well. Do not quench the spirit. Do not despise prophecies, but test everything. Hold fast to what is good. Abstain from every form of evil. So you're evaluating that sense, that revelatory sense of impression from God, and determining what is good and what is evil based on how does it do it lining up against the Word of God. But it very well could be. I mean, he's wrestling with wisdom. What does it look like in this moment? And sometimes it's really hard for us to discern such things. But it's very possible that he had that sense of, okay, it seems most loving and most wise in this moment to act in a way that in this moment, the decision I'm making is non-compromising. I'm still honoring of the Lord. It's not wrong for her to go. I'm still alive and able to fight for her. I'm going to be near her, and we'll take the next step. Lord, please help us. Please protect her. Those could have been his prayers. We don't know that, but it's very possible. Beverly. So Beverly's point, well taken, that when we're talking about social dynamics, what we're talking about is not simply men and women, but we're talking about the fact that these three men also had social status and leadership within the community, whereas the language of these women is that they were taken. And so there is what opportunities they had to consider, to assess. We don't get a sense that the women had the choice that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were actually being given. And what role Mordecai had in this, could he have halted the taking? Was he out shopping that morning and he comes back and Esther's gone? We don't know. What we know is that he is a faithful cousin slash father figure who is ever present, deeply concerned, and trusting in his God. Kenny. So, point noted. Let me respond to it. So the observation is that in saying, if indeed we're to see the line that Esther is the one who is better than Vashti, if we're supposed to see that as the first inkling of messianic hope, what we don't want to do is say, actually, like Saul was bad and needed to be replaced, Vashti was bad and needed to be replaced. That would be the wrong move, because actually what she's doing is noble. And she's intriguingly refusing, as we're thinking about like what place did Esther have? Well, here's the queen. She has social status as a woman. She's refusing to obey. I will not be exploited. And so instead she gets crushed. And yet what she's doing is noble and right as a wife. And so what I would want to identify is that better in what way? And also note that, let me just open up that passage in Esther. So when it says, if it please the king, let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she, that's not the narrator speaking, nor is it God speaking. It is the king's unwise wise guys who are speaking. So they don't, by their nature, intend, they're not seeking to allude to the 1 Samuel story. It just happens that the Hebrew phrase is only found in that other story. And so I think the narrator may be using it in order to give the first inclination of a parallel between the Samuel narrative and this narrative. But the irony is that Vashti is indeed acting nobly, rightly, purely. She has a sense of honor and does not desire herself to be exploited. We want to shape that in our daughters and nurture that kind of conviction and pray that God would give them men who would not approach sexuality as a taking thing, but as a giving and receiving thing. But within the grand purposes of God, Esther was better. In this instance, it's not a moral category like it would be for David and Saul, but only to some level. I mean, the text is going to be explicit that David, God doesn't look at the outward appearance. God looks at the heart, which implies that David's heart was somehow dispositionally more aligned with God's desires for what kings were supposed to be than Saul's heart was. We don't learn much about Vashti. The one thing we learn is that she actually has a sense of proper pride, a proper sense of who a woman is supposed to be, and that she's not a mere object to be treated without care and respect. But within the overall story, God's purposes were through Esther rather than through Vashti. And in that context, in this context, that makes it better. But I think your point is well taken, that it's important to qualify, noting not only the similarities, but the differences based on the narrative. It's really helpful. Last comment. So that's a great question. Repeating it, did the Persians have something, some special connection with lot taking? Did they think that the gods were somehow intimately linked to these lots? What I will say is, I know less about the Persians and more about the Babylonians, but I do have a good sense that the ancient world had a number of commonalities in the way that they approached life. So there was a point in my PhD days where I was working on a paper, first for class and then for publication. It's the first paper I ever presented in 2004 at the annual meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society. So I was working on preparing that paper, and one of the elements that I found out I could gain some profit from was this book, 700 pages, titled Babylonian Liver Omens. Well, it came across the librarian's desk when I ordered it through interlibrary loan, and he said, I have never seen anything like it. Babylonian Liver Omens. And the point is, what is an omen? An omen is you are looking to some object to discern the future or the will of the gods. So in a liver, you might cut it open and you're identifying the veins, you're identifying the color, you're identifying the shape. And if D and R are true, then the liver omen would say, for example, if it has three veins coming off the northwest side and or the right side, and there is a grayish color in the top left, but the rest is pink, then your goat will give birth to a donkey. I'm not kidding you. That's how it was that wacko stuff. And I didn't just make that. I made up the liver part. I don't remember the exact, but having a goat give birth to a donkey was one of the omens. So, the omens would have to do with constellations. They would have to do with, there's all different mancies, pyromancy, necromancy, astromancy. I'm trying to remember what the water is called. But where you're always looking for different signs from the gods to clarify the future. And dice would have been, or casting of lots, which stick is the longest, or you're throwing down something and looking for patterns. It would have just fallen under the context of divination. So yes, this was not understood to be a mere chance. Nothing was by chance. It was, what is the will of the gods? They didn't just set a calendar date. They wanted to discern the will of their gods. So it's dark arts that are at stake, and they are using such things in order to assess the purposes of the gods and how they'll carry it out. And so their engagement in such activity, God uses to turn on its head and overcome the serpent.
Thank you for listening to this message from Dr. Jason DeRoshi. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter their content in any way without written permission from Dr. Jason DeRoshi. For more writings, sermons, and lectures from Dr. DeRoshi, please visit www.jasonderoshi.com. Proclaiming the kingdom and treasuring the God who reigns, saves, and satisfies through covenant for his glory in Christ.